coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio. Located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
This is a very special report of the Hagman Report. With me, I've got two special guests. Number one is Steve Quayle, stevequayle.com, gen6.com. Folks, if you haven't done so already, sign up for Steve Quayle's alerts, his intelligence briefings, as well as his Q files, okay? Both. They're independent messages of the current events. The working title for this episode, and this is going to be a two-part episode, is Future Evil is Unfolding Now. Now, you remember last week, Steve and I spoke about the fact that, the more that people warned, or the more that God warned, the more people scorned. I mean, there's a lot to unpack. There was a lot and still is a lot to unpack with that episode. And it reminds me of the statement, settled science. The science is settled. How many times have you heard that statement with respect to the SARS-CoV-2 or whatever it might be, climate change, whatever. So the science is settled. But is it really? Isn't it interesting? Which brings me to the second, one of the most important guests we've ever had, and people who have signed up for Steve's Q files, all of his intelligence briefings, know of Science Guy. Now, Science Guy is not nearby. He's in another country, far away. Multiple time zones away, and has agreed to do this episode because of the lateness of the hour. Now, Science Guy has a lot of, and I'll refer to him as Science Guy, because that's how Steve refers to him in the intelligence briefings that he provides to subscribers. He's got a lot of information to share. This guy's a real deal. This guy, and I'm going to let him expand upon his early years, resume, that kind of thing. But this guy's a real guy. I mean, the real deal, the real thing. I would urge, ask politely, humbly, that everyone listens to what he has to say. And as Steve says, and I'm going to beat him to this, take this information to the Lord in prayer. Again, this is two parts. You're about to hear part one right now. Steve, I'm going to introduce you, and then you can further add or introduce anything about Science Guy. Steve, how are you?
Well, good, Doug, and thank you for the opportunity presenting your platform for both me in the States and Science Guy, and multiple time zones away around the world. American expat, but one of the most unique, and I'm saying this, one of the most unusual individuals I've ever been blessed to meet. That's not flattery. It was an answer to prayer. The story behind how I met Science Guy is miraculous. I mean, with no trying to be super spiritual or embellishing anything, it was a miracle. The purpose of bringing him on today is not just to tell you what's going on, but I have a lot of armchair scientists that tell me I don't know what the H I'm talking about. And advanced physics and all that stuff. And that's correct. I'm not a physicist. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm an author. But I'm also a guy who is charged with telling people, God's people, what's going to be coming in the future. And Science Guy is a fulfillment of the promise that the Lord made to me 50 years ago. 50 years ago, Doug, that if I'd be faithful to warn his people, he'd bring the people to me to tell me what I need to know to pass on to the people that need to understand the lateness of the hour. And now today's show, we're talking about the hour has come, the hour is upon us. So with no further ado, Science Guy, thank you. I know it's the middle of the night where you're at. And so introduce yourself and just go with as the Lord leads you. And ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about just some stuff today that you need to hear. And we're out of time, in my opinion. And I'll let Science Guy, probably in the second half of the second episode, share. So we'll go with whatever the Lord leads us. Go ahead, Science Guy.
Okay. To explain to the audience a bit about myself, my entire life has been literally a series of miracles and very unusual things. For example, I learned how to read when I was 1.5 years old. Now, why did I learn how to read? It was because I had trouble walking, but there were tons of medical books from my mother, who was studying to be a nurse, and my father, who was a physicist. He had tons of books on science and physics, and I read every one of them, much to the shock of a lot of people. So what happened was they didn't, my grandparents and my parents did not think anything unusual of it. So I went off to kindergarten. At the end of my kindergarten year, they handed me a note to take home to my parents. And I opened the note and looked and got a bit worried, actually. It said, "You and your parents need to come to the principal's office on this day." And it was about a week away. And I went home and I handed it to my father. And I said, "Am I in trouble?" He said, "I don't think so. You haven't been in trouble all year." Well, we went to the meeting. Here's what happened. They had my teacher, the principal, the area director for schools, and then the director of schools for the entire state. And they said, "We have a problem." My father looked and said, "Has my son caused you any problems?" "Oh, no, sir. Our problem is we do not know how to teach him and keep him from getting bored." And my father said, "What's the problem?" And my mother jumped in. She's tiny, like 5 feet tall. But boy, if she gets upset, has a voice, you know. She said, "Well, he can learn from his peers. You know, we all have to learn from each other." They said, "Well, at the end of the school year, we gave him literally every test we had from kindergarten all the way to the first year of college. He passed every one of them with zero errors. This has never happened before to us. We don't know what to do. And what we would like your permission to do is move him from kindergarten to the last year of high school and send him on to college early."
And Science Guy, hold on. Tell everybody how old you were.
I forgot to tell one other piece that's critical in this time frame. I was about 5 years old at the time. And at the age of 4, I had spinal meningitis and I was told I was going to die. And what happened that night at the hospital was most amazing. I forgot to tell that part because it's critical. So I heard the doctor out in the hallway, and he was saying to my parents, "Don't bother him. I can't do anything more for him tonight. He's going to die before the morning, so let him go in peace." My father said, "No, I am going to talk to my son and make sure he is right with Jesus if Jesus calls him home tonight." And so my father and I talked about that. And he said, "I'm going to go to the church and get some people, and we're going to pray for you." And then a little while later, two people showed up. I will never forget these two people as long as I live. One, she was only 4'5" tall. Now, if you can imagine a 60-year-old woman who is 4'5" tall, who has the authority of God in her, and a man next to her who's 6'8" tall, how odd that combination might be. Well, she was a widow and he had lost his wife, but they were prayer partners. And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And they both looked at me and said, we're going to kneel down by your bed and we're going to pray for you all night, just like Jacob wrestled with the angels all night. We're going to do that for your life tonight. I said, okay, can I go to sleep? Because I hurt. I could not move. Gentlemen and audience, I literally was flat on my back. I could not move anything, and I was in intense pain. When I woke up, I had zero pain, none, nothing, nada. I looked over to bed, and they were down there praying. I said, excuse me, can I go to the bathroom? And they said, oh, sure, son. And he had a smile on his face, and he kept praying. I went to the bathroom. The more I peed, the better I felt until I was all done. I felt so good, I started dancing like David in the Old Testament, you know. And the doctor came in. He said, what's that little boy doing out of bed? I said, oh, sorry, doctor. I literally jumped from the floor into the hospital bed. I forgot all about the rule of my parents, don't jump in the bed. But the doctor was so insistent that I didn't want to get him mad at me, you know, because he'd been trying to help me all this time. Anyway, then the tall man stood up, and he was much taller than the doctor. He said, doctor, I want you to do every check, every blood test, every whatever you can check to make sure that that illness is gone from that little boy. The doctor said, yes, sir. And then he sent them out of the room. And he looked at me and he said, what went on here last night? I said, well, I was here on my back in pain, like you knew. And they came in and I said, well, what are you going to do? They said, they're going to pray for me like Jacob in the Old Testament. He wrestled with the angels. That's what they were doing all night, wrestling with the angels. That doctor dropped his doctor bag. You know the old black doctor bags that they used to carry around?
Oh, yeah.
He dropped it, and it scattered all over the floor. He didn't care. He ran out of the room. Somebody had poked him with a hot needle or something. A little while later, my father came back in, and he said, son, Dr. Cohen found his Messiah, came to Jesus just now. And I'm telling you, son, that many times things that we do not understand in life happen because other people need to see the miracle to change their life. He said, yes, it changed your life because now you understand that God can literally do anything. He can deliver you from the edge of death. But more importantly, Dr. Cohen understood that too. And it changed his life totally. And that piece of knowledge has been a foundational piece of learning about the authority of God and why I went through every year of elementary, high school, college, all of that, not because I needed to learn the material, but so that I could reach out to people in my same age group.
And let me, Science Guy, let me share. I think that people need to understand that you're talking about basically you are a child prodigy. That's to the glory of God. I've known you for years now, and it's always Jesus that gets the glory. And so I think that people need to understand that without going into too much detail to give his background away, he's been called for this specific time. And I just want to put this into perspective, Science Guy, because we got only another, we've got 60 minutes in a segment. But I want you to explain how God opened the doors for you because of what his gifting was. If anybody was given the gift of wisdom, the gift of the Holy Spirit, wisdom, and the understanding of his times, and the understanding of advanced science, I wanted you to get into the background if you're science. For instance, you know, the subject of how did you end up in Washington, D.C., creative solutions, obviously your inventions, and then we'll get into the subject. I think it's really critical for people to understand the clearance of, quote, top secret and above information, because there's so much stuff on the internet, SG, that basically people don't know what to believe. Now, ladies and gentlemen, before I turn it right back over to him, you're talking to somebody that reads 6,000 words per minute and has pretty much a photographic memory. So God had to do something in his life, bring him back from the point of death as a small child, and to learn to read at that age is it's miraculous. So I want you just to listen to the rest of the testimony, but also about his background and how he did end up in Washington, D.C., and then being flown all around the world. And SG, go where you feel is good, but we've got to get into that because right. We've got so much coverage, time to cover, only so much.
Got it. Okay. Now, what happened as a result of that meeting was my father agreed to take me to the National Laboratory where he worked every evening. After school got out, and I would go up and I would talk with all the famous scientists. They're all who's who in the, things from the Manhattan Project and other advanced projects back in the 50s and 60s. That's also the segue that got me into Washington, D.C. happened like this. I was working at a consulting company, and they had a big client who wanted some consultants. And so they took me over.
Now, wait, SG. How old were you when you got your job as a consultant? What time are we talking about?
I was about the age of 24.
Okay.
Okay. And so I was for the heavy duty stuff they were looking for, I was literally young. Okay. But I walked into the place, and the man that I met, he was American Chinese, a genius, and very good with people and science. And we talked a while. He took me first to one of his groups and another, and after that, another group and another group, and then came back and told the recruiting guy or whatever his official title was that had brought me over there. He said, I have a problem. And I looked at the guy and I said, no, you don't have a problem. If God wants me here, I'll be here. If he doesn't want me here, I won't be here. He said, no, that's not the problem. The problem is all three groups desperately want you. They each have a problem that's unique, that when you were talking to them, you gave them some things that actually right then and there helped them begin to come to solutions that they had been wrestling with for weeks. And I said, well, I have an idea. Why don't you just, instead of assigning me to a group, assign me to your office to let me be a kind of resident, bring your problem down to my office and I'll help you out kind of person. And he said, okay. I have a special group that I could use for that purpose because I have to have you report to somebody because human resources demands that. And I said, okay. Anyway, so what happened was I ended up consulting inside that company to as many as 200 people at any given time. And one day, guy rolls into my office. He unrolled a whole bunch of blueprints and laid them on my desk and said, we got a problem. I looked at him and said, well, what's the problem? I see you have a thing here, and you redacted all the locations, but I know what all the equipment is. What seems to be the problem? He said, it's not working right. I said, oh, well, I'll tell you what. Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., you bring the people who are in charge of this project from the other company you're working with and the guy from the government, and we'll sit down and solve the problems in real time together. And the guy looked at me and he said, are you that sure of it? I said, yes, sir. I said, okay. So they came in the next day. We spent the entire day. I shaved off 6 months of a project because of simple, clear thinking. Now, remember, folks, science is as much about people as it is about technology and atoms and all that stuff. Remember, people are the key. And if you can see how people think and where they disagree and what the blockages are, you can open up the windows and people can then freely communicate. Happened consistently. From that point on, I learned a lesson that outside of my family, most people do not take the time to understand each other. Okay? And to that end, we solved that problem. And the next day, another guy shows up from another department, says, we got a problem. I said, oh, what's the problem? He said, well, we need your help, and we need you in Washington, D.C. this Friday. I said, okay. Go down the hall and talk to my boss. He came back. He said, the boss said it's okay. So I went to Washington, D.C. one day. Boy, were they in trouble. They had 4.5 acres of non-functional computers. They had a problem. Consistent. It was random shutdowns. Okay. Brand new computers. And I looked at them and said, I think I have an idea what it might be. Back to my lab and find out. And he said, can you come back next Thursday and be here Thursday and Friday? I said, well, you talked to the boss and set it all up. Well, it turned out that what was supposed to be a 6 weeks, one day a week effort turned into a 10-year intense time in the technical halls of Washington, D.C. And I actually set a record. I was the longest running consultant who was also rented out from that company to the government. So I was a double layer consultant, if you understand what I'm saying. Well,
and why I'm going to stop you there too, SG, without going into detail, because obviously everything that's in your past, the, you know, a lot of it is, quote, you can't talk about, but share, you can talk about the agencies and the different, you're still allowed to talk about that, because I've seen. Why don't you tell people, because no offense, you need to tell it, you know, the way it is, because when we're going to get in next in the interview is obviously you can explain, you lived in the world. of all the security clearances. So please explain who you were working for in D.C. and where they shipped you without giving any, you know, stuff away that'll
trouble. Very simply, I was rented out to AT&T. And for all intents and purposes, I had literally, gentlemen, the most unique ID badge, if you will. It was authority to go. It had a red ring, which meant I was a consultant. It also had a gold ring and a flag in the background, which said I could go to any AT&T facility anywhere in the world and any Sandia or Los Alamos facility in the world without prior permission, meaning I didn't have to fill out a pile of paperwork, just show up with my badge and I go. Well, now this was a wonderful thing for the people like NSA, DIA, NRO, all those magic three-letter agencies that used to not exist. Well, they all had mega, 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 mega problems. And it was in that era of helping them solve problems that I had to declare, now hear this well, I had to declare my faith and my morality and set boundary conditions because I would not do things that were immoral and against God's law.
And I want people to understand that. Ladies and gentlemen, I can fill in the blanks. Obviously, I know I'll be very guarded in what I say, but Doug, in essence, the the places he went around the world, communication, command, and control are primary. We're watching it even in the Middle East and also the Ukraine. But I think it's important, Science Guy, that you explain to people how critical communications was and is. And we're watching all the potential cyber attacks and everything. So please continue on. I don't want to interrupt you, but I want people to understand.
I will make sure they understand.
And if I can just piggyback a question on there, and Steve, tell me I shouldn't do this question, but can you give an approximate time period that that's taking place, or would that be?
I was in D.C. Well, this you're going to laugh about because this. Some things got pretty funny at times. I was in D.C. from early 80s until the end of the 90s. So it's like almost a 20-year spread, okay? And I was sitting in a room, and it was another communications and computing company, well-known, and they told me I got to go in this room and talk to some guy from the government. And I said, okay, fine. So I went in, and they had some accounting guy from their company. I guess he was the contact to this government guy. And so the government guy says to me, Doc, are you willing to do the following project? And he outlined the project. I said, oh, sure. We just have to work out how the money flow works and a bunch of minor details, but I'll be glad to help you out. And the accounting guy popped up and he said, he doesn't have the authority to authorize my company to do anything. And the government guy said, I didn't ask you if I needed your help. I don't. I asked him, is he willing to help me? And the rest of it is details that we'll figure out. And if you get in the way, I'll make sure you're out of the way. And I thought that guy was going to burst a blood vessel. But that's how it went. because I was not afraid of anybody for any reason. Why? I walked in and I walked out with Jesus by my side. If he wanted me there, I was there. And they took me over to a building one time and said, oh, we need to interview you for a new position. I said, okay, well, I'll go. As we got closer and closer to the building, I asked the driver, I said, two things. Pause the car right here for a minute and answer me this question. What's the name of the project that runs in that building? And he said, it's the Lucifer Project, sir. It's the biggest project in East Coast right now. And they want you to be the head. I said, you see this car? Take this car, turn around, drive me back to my hotel. I'll get my bags, and then you drive me to the airport. I'm gone. And he looked at me and he said, yes, sir. I'm not going to go against you, because there's something in my heart that says, you know what you're doing. I said, thank you. That's exactly what happened.
Science Guy, will you explain the Lucifer Project?
Sure. I later dug out what it was. I walked away simply because of the name. The Lucifer Project was all about preparing the communications and watching and the words you want to use, all the things that an entity, a being, need to spy and watch and attempt to manage an entire globe of people.
A surveillance panopticon that's already in existence right now.
It was in existence since the mid-80s.
Wow.
Okay, no joke. And let me tell all of you something. And hear my words carefully. And I'll even repeat them if you don't understand them. Every phone call, every text message, every chat message, anything that you do in communications is recorded in no less than the world simultaneously. Okay?
You cut out.
Science Guy, you need to repeat that. You cut out.
Yeah. How many places? Sorry. How many places?
Not less than 12.
Okay.
Okay, that means even this Zoom call, okay, it's intercepted at the level of, you know, bits flying around on fiber optic cables. That's how low the interface is. And one of the gadgets that I invented that caused everybody to, you know, shudder and shake when I rolled into their office was a device that could, a fiber optic cable can handle thousands of telephone calls at one time because it divides up the bits from, if you're going at 2.5 billion bits per second, and the phone call only issues 64,000 bits per second, you can divide up the thing and figure out exactly how many phone calls are on that fiber. Okay. Now, if you had a gadget that could listen and go in and pick out one phone call from that list of thousands or more phone calls on the fiber, and then do voice print identification, you got something, right?
Yep.
Bang. I don't care what phone you're on. I don't care if it's a burner phone that you run down to Walmart and buy a talk and toss phone, whatever they call them these days. You know, it comes with, it's a phone and a preloaded SIM, and you load it with money. And then when you're all done, you throw it away and you think nobody knows how to find you. Well, guess what? The minute you open your little mouth, you're found. Bang.
If I can ask this question, Steve, and again, please feel free.
Go right ahead. Ask. Okay.
Now, Steve, I want for topical relevancy here. I want you to check my questions. But so this is back in the 80s, early to mid 80s. My question would be, with the reverence of Ronald Reagan as president back then. Okay, obviously there has to be levels of clearances, right? So my question would this be under the auspices of or approval of or knowledge of Ronald Reagan, for example? Or is there go ahead.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, let me help you understand that. And the answer is absolutely yes. One time, I was called to go to Washington, D.C. I said, cool. And I said, where am I going after that? The guy said, I don't know. So I handed him two suitcases. One had cold weather clothes and one had warm weather clothes. Now, I had my green parka because it was snowing outside. I had my blue jeans and my red Hawaiian shirt.
Ah, man after my own heart. Go ahead.
Okay. And my white sneakers, okay? So, I go out, and there's this row of cars. Even banged on the door at 5:30 in the morning. I said, okay, let me get ready. And we rolled out. And it was the Air Force car in the middle and some state police in front and back. And we rolled out to the airport. We got to the airport, we rolled right out to the tarmac where the plane already had the engines running, all four. Okay. So I ran up the stairs and the Air Force guy was right behind me. And there was a Marine there too. And we sat down in the seats right next to where the door is on the airplane. And the pilot said, our esteemed guests have arrived. We can now push back and immediately take off. And I said, well, okay. wasn't expecting to get announced that way, but anyway, it is what it is. So we got there and we landed in Washington, and it was like a caravan. There were like three or four of those, you know, black-looking sedans that you always see in the motorcades for presidents. Well, they stuffed me in one of them, and there was things in the front and things in the back, and we rolled on. We drove right into the White House, right down to the basement, got out, went down the elevator. And I said, oh, hi. And one guy, he was like a general. And he said, does this man have the authority and the clearance to be in this room, in this meeting? In that tone of voice, he said it. And I just softly looked at him and said, you see the gentleman at the end of this other end of the table down there? He's your boss, right? The top boss above you, president. He was the one that told me I have to show up and sent people to fetch me from my house. And I haven't had breakfast, so if you'd be kind enough to send somebody to get some orange juice and toast, I'd be thankful. And they did that right away, actually. And I looked at him and I said, if I remember right, you're the one that's having the problem that I'm here to talk about. Would that be correct? And he kind of, have you ever seen a guy at a conference room around a table that wants to hide it? He can't figure out where to go. He wants to duck under the table or escape out of the room, but he can't because all the fingers are pointed at him. That's how the guy was. And an admiral across the table said, "He got you, Fred. You better listen up." And so then I said, "Do you have a whiteboard I can borrow?" And I said, "Yeah, we'll get you the stuff. Hang on." And I just went to the whiteboard and started drawing out the stuff for what I thought was the problem. I said, "Is this what you guys called me in to talk about?" And that general, he said, "How does this guy know all about my project? And he's not even on the list of people cleared to hear my project." I said, "Well, sir, about 6 weeks ago, somebody unrolled a pile of blueprints in my office with all the dates and locations and junk redacted. And the problem looks exactly like what I'm drawing on the board here. And the only thing I had to fill in was where in the world your problem was, which I figured out by going to a globe and a pile of maps and figuring it out." Then he turned to the end of the table and said, "Who is this guy anyway?" And the president looked at him and said, "The best young man I know to do the job. And if we're honest and open, he'll help. If you start telling him stories and try to hide, he'll walk out the door. And there's nothing I can do to prevent that." So they got open real quick. Problem got solved. That was how most of my time in that town was spent. They'd have these dire problems, mostly because they were hiding. They were trying to hide behind the secrecy of a clearance. Now, that's a perfect segue to go in to talk about clearances. There's basically three categories. One, there's what's called a Q clearance. Anything related to nuclear weapons is Q clearance type security. And the reason that it's different than all other clearances is because they check carefully the science and engineering background of each and every person that has a Q clearance, in addition to their people, who they know and things like that. Who are their relatives?
Yeah, their circle of friends and associates.
All that stuff, okay? But they wanted to be sure. For example, I walk in and they knew right away that If I walked in, worked on something, and walked out, I walked out with complete memory of everything, down to the last wire, okay? And there's an example of that. There was a new young hire. She just got promoted to the job of supervisor. And my boss asked, would I work under her for a while to break her in? He said, because she's a little bit uppity, but I think with some help from you, I can calm her down and turn her into a good supervisor. I said, sure. So she said, come on, we're going to go over Fort Meade and I'll show you around down in the basement. And I said, okay, cool. So here I was with just me, no, I didn't bring my badge or anything like that. She said, you don't have one of those fancy badges let you get anywhere or whatever. I said, you know, you're the one running the tour. I'm just with you. And so we went downstairs to the basement where all our happy machines are. And some of the people there said, oh, hi, Doc. How you doing? I said, oh, I'm just here on a tour. She's running a tour for me. I said, okay. If you have any questions, let me know. So we walked up to this one piece of equipment. And I said to her, yeah, I know about that. Is it revision 1, 2, 3, or 4? And she said, I don't know. How do you know? I said, well, come around back. We'll find out. And I looked at a couple of the wires because each revision had some wires to fix errors in the printed circuit board. And I said, well, this one here is revision 2. This one over here is revision 4. And she said, how do you know that? I said, oh, well, I invented that box. I should hope I know what it does. And I should hope I know what each revision is. And her jaw dropped so far open. I said, you better close your jaw or birds are going to fly in. And she just went silent for a while. And she said, let's go over here to this thing over here. I said, oh, yeah. And I started reeling off the specifications. She said, ooh, that's mega super ultra top secret. I said, oh, yeah? I did that one, too. And we walked down another aisle, and I said, yeah, I had a team that we worked together, and we did that. And she came back to the office after we left the fort and drove down the road to the office, and she went in and talked to the boss, and she said, you didn't tell me he knew all that stuff in there. And he said, what did you learn? She said, I need to know how to treat people with respect, regardless of how they dress, regardless of how they're introduced. And I said, good, you're going to go a long way with an attitude change like that. Because, again, I was in my famous red Hawaiian shirt. You got to wear it, Steve, when you go to a government agency, especially a three-letter one.
I got to tell you something, science guy. Certain three-letter agency people made sure when they were intimidating one of my associates, they all wore Hawaiian shirts to give me a message. And I think people need, are you allowed to tell? I mean, if nobody knows what Fort Meade is. I mean, we've got listeners all over the world. You want to tell what Fort Meade is?
Oh, sure. That's the home of the NSA.
So Doug, this is a Doug time. You are the linear investigator. So I hope people are understanding the bona fides of who is on this report for their sake, for all our listeners' sake, yours, mine, ours combined, because Science Guy is going to teach people about not only the things of the technology world and the spy world, nothing going to be classified, it's going to be released. But the point is that by understanding, ladies and gentlemen, the Bible's very clear. Know those who labor amongst you. And Science Guy is the author of the incorporated or related private briefings we send out by subscription. So, you know, it's interesting because all of the critics out there can't argue against the truth. They can deny it, but they can't argue against it. So Science Guy, you know, proceed with the next levels of security clearances. Because again, you know, I wish we had all day.
But yeah. Okay. There we go.
I just want to say this real quick. Because this gives you some inside baseball, folks, of the workings of the government, unfiltered. So just so you know, okay, that's what it is. So, okay, we left off.
It is raw. It is unfiltered.
Right.
And I'm telling it like it is.
Okay, good. Now, after Q, Clarence, go ahead, sir.
Okay, so there are different levels of Q clearances, but if somebody says it's a Q clearance, it only has to do with nuclear weapons, period, the end, okay? Now, in military land and civilian government, there's classified, that's basic, you know, don't share it with the public. Then there's secret, there's top secret, and what's called TSSI, or top secret special compartmentalized information. In other words, in order to get a TSSI clearance, you got to have a top secret clearance, and then the individual project that you're working on has to approve you to work on the project and have the information regarding the project. So, people, remember this. People in D.C. live and breathe and die by their security clearances, because don't have a clearance, can't work. Well, wait a minute. Hold on. Back up. There's one way you can, by being precise, careful, and honest and open to them, and solve a problem they themselves cannot solve, and then the magic clearance genie comes by and says, you got one of them. And you then, like me, I scratch my head and say, well, what do I need that for? I already knew the information before I walked in the door. But if it makes you feel better that you consider it some kind of tip-top, ultra-mega, super-duper, don't walk out without it secret, okay, that's cool with me. And I said, but remember one thing. With God, there are zero secrets. None. None at all. From the beginning of eternity to the end of eternity, God knows everything all the time at the same time, so there's no secrets. Consider that. Now, there's also another category which is even the first two categories, Q clearance and secret and top secret, that's, you know, pretty benign. But there's a thing called majestic clearances. Those are flat out pure evil, because those are what the fallen angels use to communicate with humans. They're human minions, which is the high level elites, the high level military elites, etc., etc., etc. Okay? Now, I got to tell you something. I got called into the White House by one of the presidents, and he wanted me to do something, and I said, no, sir, I cannot do that because it violates some biblical principles. And his wife was there, and she said, you have to tell this man to get out of this office before he has to kill one of us. And I said, I'm not going to kill you. It would be your rebellion against God that would kill you. And if you tried to harm me, then for sure you'll die, unless it's a time for me to go to heaven. And she just begged me, please leave the office. And I said, sir, you want me to leave? Cool, I'm gone. Bye. That is, gentlemen and audience, the power of God at work. Never go anyplace, especially in that town, without bringing Jesus with you. Just some advice.
You want to deal with the denial of MJ-12, and then we need to get to MJ-13 because, Doug, obviously, I didn't know there was an MJ-13. I knew there were levels of MJ-12, and I knew that it was up to, in my case, the generals to, and as Science Guy just said, when someone's granting you a certain access or clearance level, they have to sign off on it. Is that accurate, Science Guy?
Yeah. Not only does one or more security pukes have to sign off on it. I'll tell you one thing that happened to me. It was after the fact that I had done some work. Guy shows up and says, "I'm obliged to talk to you for a while." And he had this folder that was like 8 inches thick. And I said, "You mind if I look?" He said, "Well, I'm not supposed to show it to you, but it's your whole history from when you were born until now." I said, "Oh, okay. No need to look at it. I kind of know my history anyway." I said, "What's your job?" He said, "Well, I'm their head shrinker. I'm supposed to talk to you for like 2 or 3 hours to figure out if you're a sneaky kind of guy or what are you?" I said, "Oh, okay, I get it. You're supposed to figure out my brain and only 2 or 3 hours, especially when you have that stack of paper telling you who I am." He said, "Yeah, I know. In your case, it's a total waste of my time and your time, but we're obliged to talk, so let's talk about something fun," which we did. And he said, "You're a very interesting guy." I said, "So are you." I said, "Tell your boss to get over the fact that not everybody conforms to the Washington, D.C. and NATO standard of security, and it's my life." I said, "Yeah, I won't tell secrets. No point in it. And some of the stuff they hide is not even worth hiding. And that's why they hide it. They try to hide the money they're wasting." And I called them on a lot of that. Remember, gentlemen, how do you think all of those big super-duper what's-it programs get funded? They get funded because money gets funneled from different departments all across the government into the super-duper ultra-mega-secret thing hidden underground someplace. That's how it happens. Follow the money, and you'll find the heart of whoever is there when you follow how they spend their money. Okay? They spend their money here, then that's where their heart's at. Even God said that. So.
Is it, if I can ask a question about following the money, is it wasteful, or is it redirected into, if, for example, $1,000 toilet seat, for example, is that money, are they really paying that and the money's being squandered? Or does it go in someone's pocket, or does it go for block op programs, or all of the above?
It's like this. Let's talk about those $10,000 toilet seats. I remember that very well. The actual toilet seats were $5 a shot from the shipper, the factory, because they ordered a bunch of them. $5 went to the general that signed off on the $10,000 toilet seat. The other $9,990 of that toilet seat went to the Black Ops project.
Got it.
See how it works?
Yep.
And yes, even back then, They all had their fingers in the till. That's a quick example. That's why Putin shut them down with the oil thing they were doing in Syria, because they were stealing the oil from Syria, get this, and selling it to NATO and pocketing the money, all of it. And Syria was not getting paid anything.
And SG, you're talking about U.S. military assets doing that, correct?
I certainly am.
And I just want Doug, and again, it's really critical. So when, because of your investigative skills, and ladies and gentlemen, SG has made himself available to us to pretty much ask him anything. And so, Doug, you know, I think that he said a statement, and I want you to expand upon this, please, SG, because the Russians have superseded the Defense Department's ability, due to all the graft and corruption, to even develop any type of equal weapon system, such as the hypersonic missiles, such as the Poseidon torpedoes. So can you explain to the people, because our private briefings, which you've written some of the most detailed stuff on, you know, I mean, they get better briefings than a lot of the people in the military, because the military don't even know from, let's say, one department to the next that, gee, there are 100 megaton nuclear torpedoes, or gee, there is something that's a Hell Reaper, or, you know, Satan 1 and Satan 2 missiles. You know, I mean, because of all the graft and corruption, so little money gets assigned or put into the actual production of advanced weapons.
Let me explain that to you.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I'm going to use one of the biggest single military projects in history, which is the F-35 project, okay? And I'm going to compare it to the Manhattan Project in World War II. In World War II, there was no graft and no time for graft, because it was a war. And if you screw up, you die, bottom line. Because if things didn't work out, and you needed what you were working on, you knew what would happen, okay? And the F-35 program, gentlemen, it's $1.5 trillion program, the biggest program ever initiated dollar-wise. However, if I strip away $1 trillion out of that project, I would still have plenty of money to do all the engineering that they did for $1.5 trillion.
Well, that's and are we allowed to talk about all the F-35 crashes and you know?
Let's talk about that, because that's an important detail. Okay. What you don't realize is, and they finally admitted it on the B-21 Raider. There's a little one-liner down at the bottom, and the B-21 can also be used as a drone. That means remote control. Wow. Every plane designed from the F-117 forward all had full remote control built in from day one. Okay? All commercial airliners have full remote control takeover built in. Yeah, you heard me right. Okay? No joke. It's fact. And why would they do that? Well, the ostensive reason is, well, if a pilot dies or loses control or goes crazy, we can save the airplane, save the people, save the weapons or whatever, complete the mission. That's the excuse. The real reason is Control. Yeah.
Shades control of 9/11. Shades of 9/11, right?
Yeah. Shades of 9/11. You don't need a bunch of terrorists on the stupid airplane. All you do is punch the control button on your computer, take your mouse and wheel to drive the plane, drive it into the building. You're all done. The terrorists you put on the plane are only the excuse for why you're going to, you know, get all hyper. And by the way, quick side note, a friend of mine who is a structural engineer and knows the building's cold from the Twin Towers said it is utterly impossible, given the way the buildings were designed, for those buildings to fall straight down without it being placed, shaped, explosive charges triggered to bring the buildings down, because melting steel on the upper floors was not what caused the buildings to come to the ground. It was shaped explosive charges. And, oh, by the way, as an investigative explosives expert, he found traces of said explosives in the wreckage when he was asked to investigate, but he was told, don't talk about it.
Is that also the reason, SG, that obviously they wanted to get rid of that steel and all of the debris as fast as they could?
Yes, sir.
And I mean, anybody who really was in a position to know that basically there were traces of whatever the explosive was and pieces of detonators, etc. I mean, didn't a lot of them disappear, like die?
Yep.
So, you know, I think it's very, very interesting that, Doug, you know, control. And it's funny because you follow the money, you follow control. Back on the F-35, I think you told me how many problems are in the F-35 on the punch sheet that they know about.
15,000 plus.
Now, there's guys who are going to send me emails. So I worked on that. That's not true. How do people watching contemporary timing, SG, you know, F-35s crashing off carriers, you know, everything, you know, something falling out of the air, all of the issues that we're having with aircraft, and yet deny that maybe somebody's got a external control, like maybe in this case, Russia electronic weapons. See, in America now, and obviously you're an expat now, the bottom line is propaganda. Anything that's a truth is either you're a propagandist for Russia, you're a Russian agent, you're a Russian mouthpiece, but everything is designed to keep people away from knowing the truth. And propaganda is a lie, but the truth is not propaganda.
The truth is
on the cover of mine.
Here's the truth, gentlemen. Turns out that 48 hours ago in the Ukraine, there was a young conscript, you know, what do you call it? A drafted Russian soldier driving a truck. He didn't know what it was. He was just told to drive it from here to there. It was the control center for one of the latest versions of their electronic warfare system that they were trying to park up near the eastern border of Ukraine. Okay. Well, the Ukraine soldiers found it and they're kind of looking it over. And I suppose that they're going to send over some US engineers or something to look at it, whatever. But bear in mind, Russia has some of the most advanced and complex electronic warfare systems and 3D radar, meaning stealth aircraft are really not stealth aircraft. Singularly, the most stealthy aircraft the U.S. ever built was the F-117. And that's because Kelly Johnson, the guy who designed it to have the smallest radar cross-section, regardless of how you looked at the airplane, except directly from the bottom of the airplane or the top of the airplane, which most radar systems are not doing. They're looking at one of the, you know, from an angle, okay? All the other stealth aircraft are designed to present a small radar cross-section from the front side of the aircraft. And I don't pay a lot of attention to the radar cross-section on the side and the back of the aircraft. That's a problem, because if you're looking at space in the sky in three dimensions, and you look at it from multiple angles at the same time and pull it all together, you'll see that little ghost image called the stealth airplane, and you can get a lock on it and launch. To cover. And here's another thing. Did you guys know that all the science behind stealth aircraft was, and
you cut out again, SG. You said all science behind stealth finished
all the baseline design and technology and formulas for stealth aircraft were designed by a Russian engineer in Russia. Okay? Other people looked at his work, and collectively they decided that, okay, somebody might try to do that, but they could figure out a way around it. So they spent the next N years conquering that, and the U.S. picked up on his paper because they declassified it in Russia, and they copied his recipe to make stealth airplanes while they were busy doing how to bypass that. Okay? Classic case. They deemed it, oh, let it go, because that'll distract people. And the truth is, we can still find an airplane by using different methodology, which they did.
So Steve, we've got about 15 minutes left of this show. I just kind of want to go back and address the Majestic 12, 13. Did we address that properly, Steve, Doc?
No, I think again, SG, you need to define the different levels of Majestic and then Majestic 13, because a lot of people don't understand, and this is critical. Fallen angels, a third which rebelled from God's heaven, because of the initial authority that God created in man, they have to go through men to get the betrayal, do they not, of fellow earthlings or fellow human beings, a better word, to facilitate and accelerate Lucifer's plans for human destruction. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, that's correct. And literally, I can explain, Majestic 12 is easy. There were 12 disciples. There's 12 fallen angels that deal with messages at that level. And they built 13 to cover being able to go to Lucifer directly. Because now they have so many people and so much going on. They have legions and this and that. You know, think for a minute. Do we have any concept of how many angels there were in heaven? The answer is no, we don't. It's a massive number.
Right. An innumerable. That means you can't count them. That's what the scripture says.
That's right. And here's the important detail. A third of them rebelled. Okay? Remember that, Doug. One third rebelled. That means a third of the angels can remain in heaven praising and worshiping God, and a third of the angels can be down here like in football. You take the best tackles and whatnot to go against the other team. You got a one-on-one basis. For every fallen angel, there's one of God's angels that you can call down and defend against. There's an angel you can call down, bind them up, get them out of the way. And you say, well, how do I know this stuff without being one of those guys? They never gave me majestic 12 or 13 clarence. But I'll tell you one thing. Who's involved in all the communications going around the world in a technology sense? What companies make it possible for the internet to go across the ocean? What companies make telephone calls possible? The answer, the telephone companies. Right?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Because
I worked for the special projects related to communications, I had access way, way, way beyond what a normal person would have. Okay? Because why? I could see it at all different levels in the telephone company. Normally, they would limit people to different segments, different projects, different locations. But I saw, and that is actually one of the reasons why they love me and hate me at the same time. I came out with solutions quickly and efficiently and saved them all millions of dollars and tons of time. But at the same time, I knew way more about the thing than they did. Got to do that if you're going to solve the problem.
So, Steve and Science Guy, so what I'm hearing you say is you were given root level access without necessarily having the clearance, but had the knowledge of the clearances based on your root level access of the comms at that time, right?
That's correct. And okay. Guess what? Hear this one well. There is still communications equipment that has been in position since the mid-80s and has been upgraded as technology upgrades, but the fundamental design philosophy and firmware, aka software, that drives it has not changed. Okay? The fact of the matter is that things stay in place for a long time. Now, there's another thing that we should cover here in this first segment, because this is happening here and now. Okay. And that is a global farming crisis. There will not be enough food in any country in the world except Russia and maybe China if they solve their water issues. They stopped shipping fertilizer, so they would have enough fertilizer to use in country. Okay. They did that 2 months before Russia invaded the Ukraine.
Again, it's important, SG, to make sure everyone understands. In essence, there's multi fields of battle in World War III that's now underway. And it's the, if you will, the policies that the highest agencies or the agreements that were put into place, they knew the timing of this, and there is no fertilizer available unless you want to pay in Bozeman, actually in the Gallatin Valley, fertilizer, I'm told by guys who farm 11 times. In other words, it used to be $200 an acre, now it's $2,200 an acre. Can you expand, please, and may God grant us a grace, Doug, you, I, and SG, to get across to people how dire the food situation is becoming. And again,
okay.
Yeah,
let me just jump right in.
Yep.
Let's take the U.S. alone, okay? 65% of all tillable farmland, that means all farmland that is not in a drought situation, all farmland that has enough to plant with, 65% of it is being paid not to farm. You hear that, gentlemen? Not to farm. Okay, so they're paying the farmers not to plant crops. Well, that lightens the load, I suppose, on no fertilizer, but it sure doesn't do anything for the food for people's tummies. Okay, next thing, LPG, propane, is up 2 to 4x already. And what is it? Why is LPG important for farms? Do you guys know? If not, I'll tell you.
Go ahead.
The grain dryers for corn, wheat, soybeans are all fired by LPG furnaces because natural gas doesn't roll out through the Midwest into those big rolling farms. Big tank trucks with LPG roll in and unload their, you know, 40-foot trailer load of LPG into the local storage tank, and they use it to dry the grain. Well, it's going to cost you 4 times more money this season, minimum, to dry the grain, if you get any, because you don't have any fertilizer. Okay. Then the next one, the herbicides, the things they use to keep the weeds down, they're included in what was cut off in the fertilizer cutoff. The high volume herbicides, you know, weed suppressors. Okay. Now, what happens to, you know, you've seen pictures, those big farms of wheat and corn and all of that. And the combines go through and blah, 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 blah. You've seen all of that. You've seen videos. You've seen pictures. Okay. What if you don't put herbicide on your farm for 1 year? You know what happens? Can you guess what happens, Doug?
I would say the weeds would overtake the crops, and you'd have a strangling effect on the crops.
For 7 years. 7 years following the year you failed to use the herbicides.
Okay.
Okay. That means that land is no longer good for farming until you put herbicide on it for 7 years to kill off all the weeds that you let grow wild the first year.
Hmm.
And that's the thing too. That's the production side of things. Then the seed is, the same people that told me, SG, about the farmer friend, told me, he said, Steve, the seed is not only four times expensive, but a lot of the farmers are holding back their seed because they can't replace it.
Correct. There is no more seed. You know why?
GMO.
Okay. The Monsanto seed farms that generate GMO seeds all had 95% crop failure, so there ain't no.
Yeah, it's basically a collapse in the complex structure of commercial farming. And you know, what is it? The chain is only as strong as its weakest link. But again, you know, address the transportation. It's nothing. Can I say this? We've got imaginary food coming on imaginary trucks to imaginary shelves that even are putting up pictures of food that used to be there. That's no kidding. That's a real event.
Yep. And guess what? Nah, nah, warning, warning. Nah, nah, nah. Listen to this. Do you guys have any idea how much diesel is used in farming?
A whole boatload.
No, but I know you know.
Go ahead.
Okay. Let's follow it. Does Farmer John have a John Deere tractor? Yes or no?
Sure.
Okay. Well, diesel. Okay. Farmer John has a combine, runs on diesel, and go down the whole shopping list. And then the trucker that comes by to pick up all his bulk corn harvest and wheat harvest and blah, 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 blah. Trucks, tractors, and trailers, you know. And then they go to the processing plant and get processed. Oh, wait a minute. Some of those processing plants are powered in part by diesel engines in the power grid. And you say, what? Diesel engines? I thought we had things, big things like nuclear energy and, you know, high efficiency coal. Well, electric power is a real interesting thing. And I'll just tell you this real quick. As the power supplier, you have to adapt instantly to changes in energy, and you have to predict ahead of time how much energy is going to get used during any given 8-hour period in the day, because if you'll have a gas turbine or a diesel power generator for what they call peak load. If you start them up,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If you start those up to be ready for a peak load during that 8-hour window, and you never sold any of that electricity, you just wasted a ton of money for the electric company. So the guys that do that work are the highest paid guys in the whole electric industry, okay? But you need diesel or you need natural gas. Europe, instead of diesel, it's all natural gas turbine based, okay? That's why they're so dependent on diesel, gasoline, and natural gas in Europe. Anyway.
Which is why, and I'm going to interject here because we only have about 1 minute left of this part one, which is why what's happening in Ukraine, between Ukraine, Russia, and NATO and such, is so critical in our view, in my view anyway, to the beginning, the starting point, because Ukraine is the starting point of what is coming next. We have Steve Quayle and Science Guy and myself talking, and this first part one has been about, well, establishing his bona fides, but going through how he got to where he is, what he knows, and now the product coming next in part two, the product of that knowledge. You're listening to the Hagman Report. Again, special guest Steve Quayle, stevequayle.com, gen6.com. Make sure you sign up for Steve Quayle's private briefings and Q Files. And folks, thank you for tuning in. You're not going to want to miss part two. Very critical information coming up. God bless. Have a great night for tonight.